Okay, it's 9:30. We'll call this meeting to order for Wednesday, May 17th. We have a quorum. Doug's on his way to
Indianapolis
for a county insurance meeting. So we move down. We have a few proclamations. Bill, will you read the proclamations?
My pleasure, Mr. Chair. Proclaiming May 15th, 2017 as National Peace Officers Memorial Day and May 14th through 20th as National Police Week in Lincoln County. Whereas the Congress and President of the United States have designated May 15th as Peace Officers Memorial Day and the week in which it falls as National Police Week, and whereas the members of the law enforcement agencies in Lincoln County play an essential role in safeguarding the rights and freedoms of the citizens of Lincoln County, and whereas it is important that all citizens know and understand the problems, duties, and responsibilities of their police agencies, and that members of our police agencies recognize their duty to serve the people by safeguarding life and property, by protecting them against violence and disorder, and by protecting the innocent against deception and the weak against coercion or intimidation, and whereas the men and women of the police agencies of Lincoln County continuously provide a vital public service, now therefore the Lincoln County Board of Commissioners call upon all citizens and upon all patriotic, civic, and educational organizations to observe the week of May 14th through 20th as National Police Week, in which all citizens are encouraged to honor police officers, past and present, who, by their faithful and loyal devotion to their responsibilities, have provided dedicated service to their communities, and in so doing, have established for themselves an enviable and enduring reputation for preserving the rights and security of all citizens. We further call upon all citizens to observe Monday, May 15th as National Peace Officers Memorial Day in honor of those law enforcement officers who, through their courageous deeds, have made the ultimate sacrifice and service to their community, or have become disabled in the performance of duty, and to recognize and pay respects to the survivors of our fallen heroes.
Good morning, Commissioners.
Good morning.
I am Curtis Landers, Lincoln County Sheriff, and I want to start off the presentation this morning briefly with a short video. And just before I do, it is a graphic video, but it just kind of indicates how quickly things can happen for police officers out there. And it is very short, but just to start it off us off today. So, as I mentioned, just a short video to get us started today. And just to indicate how fast things can happen. And this was just one of several videos I could have chosen online. I don't know the details of this. I do know that the trooper was killed in this. I don't know why he's being stopped, anything like that. But just the fact that, things happen very fast. Traffic stops are something we do every day, and they're considered routine. But the problem is we have, we don't know what's going to happen when we do stop somebody. And that just kind of reinforces, how dangerous this job is. As you read, Commissioner, in 1962, President John F. Kennedy signed a proclamation which designated May 15th as Peace Officers Memorial Day and the week in which that day falls as Police Week. A memorial service began in Senate Park in 1982, attracting 120 survivors and supporters. Decades later, the event now attracts thousands of survivors and law enforcement officers to our nation's capital each year. Since the first known line of duty death in 1791, more than 20,000 U.S. law enforcement officers have made the ultimate sacrifice, and their names are engraved on the walls of the National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial. To update you on the numbers from last year, according to the National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial page, Law Enforcement Fatalities Report, so far this year, 50 law enforcement officers were killed. This is up from 36 last year at the same time. In 2016, 145 officers were killed. This number is up from 141 in 2015. So far this year, there have been 6 K-9 line of duty deaths, obviously represent our current K-9 that we have. Safety of our members is our number one priority, and you can see why it's a dangerous job, just as I showed. We believe in the Below 100 campaign and the vision to permanently eliminate preventable line of duty deaths through training and awareness. This includes the 5 tenets. Number 1, wear your seatbelt. Number 2, wear your vest. Number 3, watch your speed. Number 4, win. What's important now, which means don't get distracted. And 5, remember complacency kills. Our community continues to respect and support us. It is because of the outstanding job our members do each and every day. They truly enjoy serving our citizens and visitors. Commissioners, I want to thank you for this recognition and your support.
Thank you, Sheriff. Can I ask a question? I think it was something we discussed last year. Tragically, situations like the video you showed have been happening, from the very beginning. But this new and even more disturbing trend of officers being killed in ambush-type settings, and is there any tracking on whether that's continuing to escalate? And is there anything reasonably that can be done to reduce those kind of incidents?
It still continues to happen. The ambushes still continue to happen. I didn't read that it's actually on the decline this year, so we'll have to follow up and see if those 50 are related, meaning that I have noticed that the majority of them are firearms related, which would indicate probably some type of ambush situation going on. It's interesting because firearms now have increased over vehicle-related crashes, which, were one of the things that we could actually somewhat prevent is, we talked about watch your speed, wear your seatbelt, these type of things. But now firearms are increasing, which just means that we need to be more aware of our surroundings and I think that has helped too.
Great.
Sometimes you wonder why you pick the job you do.
It does, yeah. I'm glad we do have the people that have done that.
It's a certain kind of person to do it and then be calm on every one of the traffic stops, because I know that I've seen people that are drunk that can become violently agitated, and if you're a little overly aggressive, it could wind up in disaster both ways.
Correct.
How do we develop a understanding in the public that they take a chance when they get drunk, and they take a chance beyond just the accident, to try to get people to get away from that agitation of trying to reach a high point that can make those kind of decisions that they can have to live with the rest of their life?
Right. Drugs and alcohol, contribute to a large amount of the violence that not only against officers but against everyone. And, that's one of the things that we're working on, is trying to reducing that aspect of it, because it contributes to a large amount of the crime that we have in our community. And a lot of it is addiction, more awareness, getting people the help they need before it becomes too late. And I think we're making strides in those efforts, but I think there's a long way to go, too. I think another part of it, you know, you kind of touched on it, too, with the officer as far as, you know, you can't go up there just super, you know, you can't draw your gun every time you go up there to a car and this type of thing. It's changing now in the 21st century policing. It used to be a warrior mentality that we used to have. Now it's more the guardian. That's kind of the direction we're going. And I think that that basically fulfills all what we're trying to do as far as how we treat someone, then how they respond and treat us, too. It's all communication-based, too, when we start with that, too.
I'm glad to see that change because aggressiveness causes aggressiveness.
Yes, it can.
And I've seen individual officers that just by walking up and smiling defuse the situation rather than come up with... And they were taught that way in the past, that you were dominant in the situation, which if a person's a little bit drunk, they respond with agitation. So I'm really happy to hear that they're changing that.
And I think the guardian is a perfect way to, you know, you still, if something happens, you can respond. You still have a plan to respond if things go as they do here, too.
And that's picking the right people.
Yeah. It is.
And
training. And it is. Both are
crucial.
Crucial in this type of situation.
Yeah, and I know you're a strong believer in training, Sheriff. I heard a very interesting public radio program while driving last week. It was totally devoted to de-escalation training and totally focused on talking to people within law enforcement. And, you know, they gave an example of a case where a rural Georgia officer showed up on scene with kind of a wildly agitated but unarmed man, a mentally ill man out of control. And unfortunately, within less than a minute, he was shot dead. But then other cases where departments that have been in the lead in training de-escalation techniques, you know, have had good success. And it was very interesting to hear people, even within the profession, some very strong proponents of that kind of training, and others saying, the training isn't any good. You just have to learn on the job and learn from experience, but then counter people. And again, these were all professionals in the field saying that, now, some people just have better natural instincts than others, and like any other skill, it can be learned.
Yeah, you know, I think it can be learned, it's trained. I think it's a combination of experience with it, you know, and as we both know and work on with the number of individuals with mental illness that we deal with, I think a large portion of those individuals, de-escalation is very important to help control a situation because you have to learn the techniques that are different with individuals with a mental illness compared to someone that is just, you know, aggravated for other reasons, too.
Mm-hmm. There, the more traditional warrior stance, I assume, you know, kind of getting control of the situation through stance and voice, that's probably still going to be more effective. But with someone with mental illness, that's just one case where that probably backfires more than helps.
Direction. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, thanks for the judgment of your officers and pushing for training. I know you're a big advocate for that.
Yes, absolutely.
This type of thing. So. That'll take a motion.
Yes. Mr. Chair, I move that we proclaim May 15th as National Peace Officers Memorial Day and May 14th through 20th as National Police Week in Lincoln County.
Second. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Motion passes. Okay. So the next one, Sheriff's Officer Canine Program.
Yes. I'll invite Deputy Jeremy Gottney and Canine Bonnie up here. The canine program's been, we've had it for over a year now, and it's proven to be very successful, and Deputy Gottney can go into a little bit more of the information on how successful it's been. But if you haven't had a chance, we wanted the commissioners to have an opportunity to meet their canine and see a little bit of what Bonnie can do, and she's, you know, especially in a real setting for our deputies, having a canine out there is a tremendous help. I kind of refer back to my days when, and for some reason, Eddyville School always pops up to when we respond to an item, respond to an alarm out there. And it seemed like all the time we'd find an open door, and that means you have to go in and search. And Eddyville School is built in pieces and nooks and crannies. And when you went in alone to do it, it was kind of scary, actually, out in the middle of nowhere. And so, you know, having canine, I imagine if Deputy Gottney has had a chance to do that, it probably makes the job a lot easier to go in there. And that's just one reason. I'll let him go into a little more details about the program.
Well, again, I'm Deputy Gottney with the Sheriff's Office, the current canine handler. I apologize it took me so long to get in here and introduce you to Bonnie. We've had kind of a rough schedule last year or so. This is Bonnie. She's a four-year-old German Shepherd from the Czech Republic. She was imported to the United States through a canine facility down in Riverside, California called Adlerhurst International. It's a facility that does police and military canine training and canine sales. She's an IPO-1 titled dog, which means she competed in the sport of IPO while over in Europe, where she was titled at the basic level. And that sport, the reason they use those dogs for canine work, for police work, is because their sport mimics a lot of the stuff we do in police work. That sport is tracking, obedience, and protection work. So she is a patrol dog. There's two basic functions of police canines. There's detection dogs and patrol dogs. Detection is everything from dogs that sniff out drugs or firearms or explosives or whatever you want to teach them to sniff. Those are detection dogs. Patrol dogs, which is what Bonnie is, are trained to help us on different patrol functions. Some of the stuff that she's trained to do is building searches. So anytime we have, like Sheriff was saying, alarms or confirmed burglaries, anything like that, someone runs into the building and, you know, it's too dangerous for us to go in, she's trained to go in there for us. She's also trained in area searches, so she's trained to pick up human scent and lead us to that person. Whether it's a suspect hiding in the brush or whatever it may be, she's trained to go in there and do that for us. She's also trained in tracking. So a person runs from a scene, she is trained in tracking off of the crushed vegetation and disturbances in the ground. She can track us to where that person has gone. She's also trained in evidence searches. So anything that a suspect drops or throws, she can go find those for us, anything that's got human scent on it. And she's also trained in apprehension and handler protection. So anytime someone that's too dangerous for us to go and grab, put hands on, she can do that for us. And obviously, one of the most important for me is she's trained to protect me. So it's one of the only times she will bite without a command is if I'm being threatened or assaulted and she's able to have access, she'll bite without command. Which is an obvious plus for me. I've got a button on my belt that will let her out of my car if I'm out on a contact or traffic stop that goes bad and I need assistance right away. I can hit that button and she'll come to my aid. So obviously that's a huge plus for me. And then one of the biggest factors that she's been for us so far is a deterrence factor. People know, the guys that we deal with know we have a dog now. And there's been many instances where that has been the key factor in getting to de-escalate a situation. I've had instances where one particular instance where I was responding on a call alone, an assault call, and I pull on scene, the guy's there, and he takes off running from me. I jump out, yell, "Sheriff's Office, canine." She starts barking, and the guy stops and throws his hands in the air. So it's a huge deterrence factor, and it's worked. We've had instances where, one particular guy we searched for and found, and a couple months later, you know, Bonnie found him in the bushes, barking at him, and he ultimately gave up. A couple months later, I saw him on the street. He walks up to me, and he wanted to talk about Bonnie, but he's like, "Just as long as we leave Bonnie in the car, I'm good." But it made an impact on him, so it's definitely working. Some of the training that's gone into Bonnie, she came from Europe as a sport dog. So when I was down at Adlerhurst, we attended a six-week, 240-hour basic handler course, which was a time for bonding for her and I, as well as teaching her how to turn that sport into actual police work, because she'd never done building searches, anything like that, until that time. So I attended that for 6 weeks down in Riverside, and then we have a 4-hour a week or 16-hour a month maintenance training that we attend every month to make sure we're abiding by the standards. And then we certify annually through the Oregon Police Canine Association. Every September, October, we go over there and certify through them to make sure we're up.
Let me ask you a question.
Sure.
What does one of these dogs cost? I mean, you've talked about a training. Training costs money, and especially coming all the way from Europe.
Right.
Is that common to bring a dog in from Europe?
Yes. Most vendors import their dogs. There are some American breeders, but most vendors for police work in the United States import their dogs from Europe.
What's it cost for something like that? It seems like it would be expensive.
They are spendy. She was right about $10,000 total cost from the vendor. So the vendor we went through, Adlerhurst, he goes over every 6 weeks to Europe, and he brings back 30 to 35 dogs. And then agencies from all over the United States go down there and pick dogs, and he sells dogs to different agencies.
So you're a team.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're a team, do they scrutinize you? There's probably more people that want to be a canine handler than there are dogs available and positions available. Am I right?
Yeah, it's a pretty desirable position. As far as us here at the Sheriff's Office, I developed the proposal and got it through, and then I think when it opened up for the handler position, I think most of the guys that I work with knew how bad I wanted it, and so nobody else put in for it. So it was pretty easy for me to get it, obviously. but yeah, as in bigger agencies, especially, you know, like LAPD in New York, stuff like that, where they only have, you know, maybe 30 dogs at the most and thousands of officers, it's definitely a hard position to get into in those bigger agencies.
It's a lot of dedication on Deputy Gottney's part, too. I mean, this dog doesn't, at the end of shift, he doesn't leave the dog here. It goes home with him, too. He's with the dog 24/7, and it's part of his family also now. So it's a huge dedication for what he's doing and as part of it also. So it takes the right person to fit that spot also.
So do you have kids?
I do have kids.
You trust the dog that thoroughly that with your kids? Because he is trained to do attacks and stuff. There's nothing that you feel uncomfortable with that?
Not with Bonnie. At first, it was we warmed up slowly. She's got a kennel at my house, and she's not an inside dog. She's an outside dog. So she's in her kennel unless, you know, and a part of our policy is she can only be out if I'm there with her and supervising her. So. And that's one of the reasons why is because she is trained to pick up on certain behaviors that kids, obviously, I've got three young kids, 6, 3, and 8 months. So they're never around her unsupervised. And then they know, at least the older two know, what behaviors are okay and what's not okay and how to act when the dog's out and how to act when...
Well, that's a way to get kids to behave.
Yeah, they know not to roughhouse. They know not to roughhouse with Dad when the dog's out. So I wanted to give you just a couple numbers of what we've done so far. We've been certified since November of 2015, and which we've done 39 deployments. And there's certain guidelines that have to be met before she can be taken out of the car. We can't just take her out because someone runs. It's got to be certain level crimes and known factors of weapons and stuff like that. So she's been out on 39 deployments, which has resulted in the assist of 20 arrests. She's had 4 successful tracks. And then a couple cases, you know, that I noted where she's been a huge help was we had an assault up in Otis. I don't know, was it sometime last year? I don't remember when it was exactly. But the deputy had probable cause for an assault 1, which is the highest level assault there is in Oregon. And they couldn't get the lady to come out of the house. They had tried for a week to get her to come out, and she wouldn't come out of the house. So one of our sergeants now, asked me if I'd go up there with Bonnie and see if we can get her to come out of the house. We went up there. Initially, knocking on the door, she wouldn't come out. As soon as Bonnie kind of confronted her at the front door, she agreed to come out and gave up to us, and she's now in prison. So, another key case was just a couple weeks ago, a month or so ago, was a burglary down in Seal Rock. They had a shop that had been broken into a couple of times. Deputy responded from off duty, got called in for it, and two suspects fled on foot into the woods. So they called us from home, and we came out, got there about an hour and a half later, started a perimeter check around the building where she picked up a track off of the north side and took us to a pile of stolen property. From there, we continued back, and she took us into the brush. Big, huge wall of blackberry bushes, and she got down, belly crawled into these blackberry bushes, and the guy was in there about 20 feet, stuffed underneath the blackberry bushes. And she confronted him, started barking, and he ultimately gave up, came out of the bushes to us, which led us to a second suspect, search warrants, and several cases solved. So she's definitely been an asset to us so far. And then, like I said, many instances of deterrence, and bad guys are talking about her. They know she's here. They know she's one of our tools if we need it. So,
something I'd like to ask. This brings back memories for me about 30 years ago when I was with the News Times doing a story on then Deputy Miller and her canine, Bob. And you know, what exceptionally smart animals these are. And one thing she told me, that something that wasn't part of his training, but after they'd been together, I'm not sure how long, like say if she was out on a call and he remained in the car, and all of a sudden if he decided she'd been gone too long, he'd honk the horn. And then periodically and regularly honk the horn after that. Have you seen any examples yet with Bonnie of kind of self-initiated behavior like that?
Well, not necessarily like that. I mean, they've learned a lot since then, so they don't let the dogs have access to the cars anymore. A couple of chewed up steering wheels.
Okay. Well, that was 30 years ago.
Yeah. So she's pretty confined now. She's got a cage in the back.
Oh,
so,
okay.
You know, if she wants out of the car, or you know, if she thinks I need her help, she'll start scratching at the door and barking and stuff like that. But it's all metal now, so she can't get out of there. But yeah, she knows when we're working. She knows when my adrenaline level goes up, she'll start barking and she'll start thinking that she needs to come and help me. But
wow.
So I wanted to show you guys a couple of quick things if we have time.
Yeah, we got a minute.
Yep. There's a big quick demonstration here.
Okay.
This is the fun stuff.
Try not to hurt any of the people in the...
Yeah, any volunteers?
No, we're looking at the audience.
Can you see the corners up there?
Here.
I'll show you a couple quick bites, how she bites, and then how she'll protect me if she thinks I'm... Deputy Carter has agreed to help us out, locking. So she will. She knows that that's it's training when she's still in that jacket. But she won't do anything until I tell her to. She wants to.
This is all fun for her. She's not doing
it out of
aggression.
It's not work. Yeah.
All right, bad guys, stand still. Body.
Wow.
Wow.
All right, back, I guess. Bonnie. Who's come in.
Wow.
So one thing they're trained now is a garden bark. Instead of, you know, if they encounter a completely passive suspect, they're supposed to go in and just bark at them. Unless that suspect shows any sort of resistance, assault behavior, or tries to flee. So I'll demonstrate that a little bit for you. She's a little amped right now, but... just try not to move at all.
Yeah.
Bad guy, stand still. Bonnie. Who's? Help me. Now the last thing I'll just show you real quick 5 times is just how she'll protect me if she thinks I'm being assaulted. So, can I? So if we're just out on a contact and I have her out, which probably won't happen that very often, but if she's just out laying down and she thinks I'm about to be assaulted or someone takes a swing at me, she'll act on it. And she'll stay out on the line a long time until I come off. So. All right, bad guys, stand still. Bonnie. Post! Come in. Live.
Wow.
That was just a quick demonstration of what you can do. I appreciate it. Thanks, Sean, for helping out.
You don't need to ask. If you want the gavel, I'll give it to you.
You're good at your job. You can keep that job. Again, I apologize it took us so long to get in, but I appreciate you guys having us.
It's worth it. Thank you.
Thank you. That was good. I hope some people see that are deciding to take crime into their own hands with what can be done. That's fantastic. Okay. Get this one, the proclamation. This gets us to the demonstration.
Yeah.
We can go down to the next resolution. You want to read that one?
Yes. Proclaiming May 21st through 27th as Emergency Medical Services Week in Lincoln County. Whereas emergency medical services is a vital public service, and whereas the members of emergency medical services teams are ready to provide life-saving care to those in need 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and whereas access to quality emergency care dramatically improves the survival and recovery rate of those who experience sudden illness or injury, and whereas the emergency medical services system consists of emergency physicians, emergency nurses, emergency medical technicians, paramedics, firefighters, first responders, educators, administrators, and others, and whereas the members of emergency medical service teams, whether career or volunteer, engage in thousands of hours of specialized training and continuing education to enhance their life-saving skills, and whereas it is appropriate to recognize the value and the accomplishments of emergency medical services providers by designating Emergency Medical Services Week, now therefore the Lincoln County Board of Commissioners do hereby proclaim May 21st through 27th as Emergency Medical Services Week in Lincoln County and encourage the community to observe this week with appropriate programs, ceremonies, and activities.
Please go ahead.
You are? Okay, so 2017, it was decided to go with daily themes for the days of the week.
And I just wanted to introduce yourself.
So Monica Valencio of Pacific West Ambulance is the Marketing and Community Relations Coordinator for the county. And I'm actually back into my shoes. I've been gone for a couple of years. I was there about 3 years before. So I'm happy to be back. I also want to introduce who is not with me today. He is might be out on a vehicle today. Who knows? His name is Jeff Mathia. He is our new general manager. He has moved down here with his wife, Teresa, permanently, and is also a paramedic. So I am very, very happy to introduce him, even though I don't have him with me today. So the daily themes I would like to go over really quick. Mondays is Education Day to recognize public and EMS. Safety Tuesday to promote EMS safety all throughout. Wednesday is Children's Day to highlight special needs care for children. Thursday is Save a Life Day, and this is for bleeding control education. And Friday is EMS Recognition Day, and that is just recognizing our local EMS. And I'll go over some of those. Police Department, which were just here and had a wonderful show for us. Paramedics, EMTs, Fire Department, Security, nurses, doctors, and so on. So next week, if you would want to give them a big thank you for their services, would be kindly appreciated. And thank you very much for your recognition.
You're welcome. Don't know if I have any questions right now. Well, it's an important function you guys perform, and we appreciate you bringing this forward. And then next week, you said there'll be a...
21st to the 27th is, yes, yep. EMS week. So it's a good time.
EMS week.
I know that a lot of times we just take it for granted because it's so available and it gets to us quick, but
yes.
It wasn't always that way, and a lot of parts are remote in Lincoln County.
I'm told that our EMTs, paramedics, are some of the best that anyone has ever seen after they leave our county, and this is nationwide, in Oregon, Lincoln City. And we work under Dr. Oxenthold, and he does a very good job in training our guys. And so we're thankful for him as well.
Will they have to have training way before? I mean, how do they go about picking them, and then the training in depth? Is it just through Oxenholt, or is there advanced training? It's way more than
that. Oh, there's schooling and whatnot just for Pacific West Ambulance if you're going to be working for. They're going to be trained and with Dr. Oxenholt, yes.
You have to know how much training goes into this, I've been told.
Well, for EMTs, it's different. Paramedics is a whole other story. There's a lot of work that goes into it. If anybody wants to ask any further questions about that, please, I encourage you to come in. And we also encourage the youth to look into EMS world. So there are some classes for EMT at Oregon Coast Community College. Paramedics, there's further training outside of here, but we do need more. And we would really encourage that.
That's a fairly good paying profession.
It is. Absolutely. Good benefits, good pay, and you're doing your community a good service.
And you do have the training right here.
Yeah.
So that's one of those jobs that we hope we can fill with Lincoln County residents.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to move that we proclaim May 21st through 27th as Emergency Medical Services Week in Lincoln County.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Motion passes. Thank you.
Thank you.
So we move down to consent calendar. Consent calendar are things of routine nature. Is there anything you'd like to highlight or delete?
No, Mr. Chair, I would move for adoption of the consent calendar as presented.
Okay, I'll second it. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Motion passes. No public hearing, no decision in action. We have under discussion information, Lincoln County Coordinated Plan for Coordinated Human Services.
Good morning.
And public transportation plan.
And Mr. Chair, while our presenters are getting seated, could I make note of the fact I had a conversation with Cindy yesterday that after this presentation is finished, it's not directly related to this, but the news that came out this week of the Valley Retriever bus line shutting down, we'd like to hear from Cindy what she can tell us about that and what might be able to happen or might not in terms of filling that void. But we'll go into that after this presentation, if that's okay.
That's great. So which one of you wants to go first?
Okay, so I'm Cindy Bruce, director of Lincoln County Transit, and I have with me Jim Owens, who's been working on our coordinated human services plan, which is a requirement for continued senior disabled funding. And from AOC. Who's also been assisting with the project, and Jean Palmatier, who I've worked with for decades from the Public Transit Division. So, Bill, did you want me to hit on the Valley Retriever thing first?
Well, if you'd like to, whatever.
Okay.
Whatever you think.
Jean Palmateer can also add to this because she's been working on this at the state level, but I've been coordinating with the state to do what we can to make as seamless an adjustment as we can. So our driver has been swinging by Valley Retriever bus lines in the morning before they head over to Corvallis to make sure that there's nobody there waiting. They have put a sign on their door, but we're concerned about perhaps senior disabled folks or folks with significant amounts of luggage that might have trouble getting there. Also, when we're in Albany at the Amtrak station heading back, we'll also be looking for passengers who need to get back who purchased tickets, and if they have purchased tickets, we will honor them and get the folks where they need to go.
Long term, though, I mean, just the informal chatter I've heard, and I think the news is still filtering out, that people seem to be getting the message about, you know, that the, thanks to, in part to, I think, maybe our five-county connection, that if they need to get right up the coast or over to Corvallis and Albany, they know how to do that. But reaching, say, Portland or Bend, that seems to be, those longer public transit trips seems to be the matter of biggest concern of what I've heard so far. And will people still be able to do that, utilizing public transit in some fashion?
Yes, they can, but I'm not sure about the differences and the lengths of trips. They can get from Lincoln City up to Grand Ronde, up to Spirit Mountain, and transfer on a bus to Salem or McMinnville and get there that way. On weekends, the bus goes directly from Lincoln City to Salem, which would make it a little more seamless, I should say. And Jean Palmateer probably has more information on...
You can get to Bend through Eugene, so TAC is the company name, but they call themselves Pacific Crest Bus Lines now.
Yes.
And they're expanding their footprint in the state. We anticipate that because this was a privately operated bus system, with some state support, the vehicles that they operated were provided to them through a grant program. Cinda started this some years ago. She helped facilitate that. So I didn't introduce myself. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
And so we're hoping that the private sector picks up on this service as our first choice because it has been a viable service over the years. The second choice would be we would look at seeing if any of our transit community might pick up on the service. So, for example, the COIC service, which is called Central CET in the Central Oregon area, could possibly come back and forth from Bend or perhaps somebody else. So we have a range of options. The third option and our least desirable at this point is to incorporate it in this kind of service into what we already provide through the point system, which is a contracted service that ODOT itself operates. That's a gap filler service. We don't see that as a high need here because this has been a fairly consistently operated service over the years and is likely to be of interest to another private sector provider. To add to that a little bit, 2 years ago, state motor carrier deregulated entry into the intercity bus system. It used to be that entities like Valley Retriever had to apply and they were assigned a route. And there was some limited competition on that route. Nowadays, there is no route authority. It is a safety authority. They are provided, they have to operate under certain safety regulations, but beyond that, they can pick and choose their route. So it's more of a competitive environment. So that's the one last thing. The note on the door at Valley Retriever has Arla Miller's personal phone number, her personal office number. She's an ODOT employee of, she's part of the troops like I am. So She's been literally fielding the calls at our end and transferring them to either ODOT's PIO, depending on the nature of the call, or to CINDA, or to whomever, according to what's going on. So we're hoping that this gets resolved here shortly.
So for the public, how long do you think it might be before we can get some kind of an answer?
I have no idea. I'm sorry. I can't even guess.
Okay.
Yeah.
One other question on this. CINDA, you and I discussed this, but I'd like the public to know, too, that you had been working with Valley Retriever pretty intensively to try and help them resolve their issues, which
yes.
Unfortunately that couldn't happen. But.
Right, that's correct, and we even assisted with the vehicle because there were some issues, of course, that were going on. So, yes, we did.
Thank you.
So,
that's not the reason you're here.
For the record, I'm Ann Hannis. I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties. Commissioner Chair Thompson and Commissioner Hunt, it's a pleasure to be back here again. I've been working with AOC and ODOT on a project to coordinate public transportation and human services. The project we're talking about now, the coordination plan for Lincoln County, Lynn, Benton, and the Celettes, comes from a project or study that happened in 2013 about coordinating transportation and human services. In that, we found that over $300 million in DHS alone goes for transportation and human service-related programs, and that there are 35 programs administered by 13 different state and federal agencies. So it's no wonder that this is incredibly complex and difficult to coordinate the needs. We found for AOC, we teamed up because we felt that provision of transportation is essential, especially when counties are such important providers of human services. If people can't get to a doctor or work or even shop for groceries and medicines, they won't be able to use the services offered by counties. So this is really one of three projects, pilot projects, that came out of that 2013 study. One is a coordination project study among the three counties in the Celettes Tribe. We're also doing projects in Central Oregon and North Central. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Jim Owens and Gene Palmatier to talk more specific about the project. Gene first.
And I'll just say a few words about the subject. You know, we believe that transit's a very important community service, and it's a very important community resource for a number of people who either choose not to drive or have no other options. ODOT is pleased to sponsor this plan. We see it as an important part of planning and managing a responsive transit program. And the more that our communities become regionalized, and in your case here, many of your human services are coordinated with Lynn and Benton counties, as well as the hospital system, the Council of Governments, so the senior programs, and so on, the more important it is to find ways to be as collaborative as possible to reduce redundancies and identify opportunities to improve the services to the extent that we can do so. A great example is the relationship that Lincoln County Transit has with Benton County and Tillamook, well, the five counties, actually, and the relationship that they've developed so that the trips back and forth to Albany, which are so critically important right now with Valley Retriever going down, continue and continue to improve. ODOT would like to move toward a more regional planning process. Transit doesn't stop at the county border. And so we would like to be able to bring our viewpoint of where people go, how they travel, what they need, to be a little more regional in nature. Our four partners in this project were very kind to let us use them as a pilot. We appreciate that a lot. And I would like to be able to thank CINDA and Julie Kay for their very competent support to this planning process. And Bill Turner, the chairman of the SDF Advisory Committee, was very supportive also. So thanks to them. And now I'm going to turn it on over to Jim. Thank you.
Good morning. I'm Jim Owens with Cogan Owens Green, and Commissioner Hall, Chair Thompson, asked me to be working with you in a different setting other than Marine Reserves. The canine presentation reminded me a little bit of that process. So we're here. I do have a presentation I'm going to fly through in the interest of time, but stop me with any questions as I go through. We're here today asking for your approval of the 2017 update to your Coordinated Human Service Public Transportation Plan, which was last updated in 2009. And the key parts of it, there's a vision for public transportation in the county, a short vision. There's eight strategies, each with a set of potential actions. One of which is that we take a look at implementation on an annual basis through your special advisory committee. And a couple caveats up front that I think are important to point out is that, with the exception of strategy number one, which I'll come to in a second, all the strategies are equal priorities, and we recognize that in order to implement a number of the proposed actions, additional research and certainly additional funding will be required. And there are other parties out there that need to help us implement this plan. It isn't just Lincoln County Transit. We do need to be involved into the health services community and the human services community and other providers. And this is a living document. It will be updated as we go through other planning processes. You're currently initiating a transit development plan, and the work that comes out of that will need to be integrated into this effort as well, and vice versa. So as Cindy indicated, this plan is required in order to receive federal and state funding for transportation services to special needs populations. And that's really the focus of the plan, is services for older adults, persons with disabilities, and low-income persons. And we've, unlike earlier versions of the plan, we've expanded the special needs populations to specifically address veterans and minority populations. And we're looking at how we get the special needs populations to medical services, to employment, and other essential services. And it's more than just transit. It's the demand response service, it's the non-emergency medical transportation, the NEMT transportation, the taxis that take people to medical services, etc. And a really critical aspect of the plan is, how do we better coordinate between transportation providers and the human and health service providers? Really, that's the heart of the plan, is how do we have the human and health services communities know about public transportation services and match their clients to them, and vice versa. And as Ann mentioned, this is part of a three-county and select tribe project. The key components are updated demographics and updated inventory of the services that are out there. We did extensive stakeholder outreach, more than 50 interviews in the region. There's a summary of the funding since the last plan update and strategies of what we do if there are shortfalls in funding. And then the heart of the plan are needs, strategies, and proposed actions. What's different from the last update in 2009 is, again, we've added a focus on veterans and limited English proficiency populations and minority populations. There's a section in the plan that speaks to the role of public transportation in emergency preparedness. We've really emphasized the health service community as partners in this. Previously, we really focused on the human services community. With the entry of the coordinated care organizations into the region, they're really an essential player. We have a section where we address the progress made since the last plan update. And again, we have this funding summary section. And we tried to make a better linkage to what we're proposing for actions and strategies to the needs. So previously, those were separate chapters. They've all been rolled into one section now. Some observations. As you know, the county's had steady population growth. We've had 5% growth since the last census in 2000. Depot Bay and Yahats and Lincoln City have experienced the greatest growth as a percentage of population. The majority of that growth has been in older adults, which is really an important fact for recognizing the public transportation service needs. And by the year 2030, you should expect 30% of the county's population will be older adults, which is a bump from 22% in 2010, pretty significant bump. And as we look out in the future to 2050, expect it to remain at about 30%. And we have similar high percentages in parts of the state like Linn County, lower in Benton County. Very high percentage of the population of the county qualify as persons with disabilities. Depending upon the information source, could be as high as 38% of the population. There's certainly an overlap between a lot of the older adult population and persons with disabilities. A lot of those are double counts. Largest concentrations in Walport, Yachts, and Toledo. Low-income population, 28% of the county's population qualifies as low-income. And that percentage is increasing in all communities except for Yahats. You have a comparatively large veterans population, 5,800 veterans in the county. It's over 12% of your population. The state average is about 8%. And about 70% of your employees are local residents, which is much higher than most counties in the region. Having Lincoln County Transit as your single provider here simplifies the service provision. We have some areas of the state where it's very complicated with multiple providers. All the cities in the county are served by intercity service, but your smaller communities lack any local transit services. Really, only Lincoln City and Newport have in-town service. Demand response is limited to the city limits of Newport and Lincoln City and is not available on weekends. Our weekend service varies. Good connections to the north, to Tillamook County, and as you know, there's a pilot project looking at how do we extend service south from Yahats to Florence, really critical piece in the coastal connection. Your advisory committee identified the lack of qualified drivers and vehicles as a real barrier to the ability to expand service, especially to rural and unincorporated areas. So the heart of the plan, we had 8 strategies, each of which is accompanied by a set of proposed actions. And the first one is that we want to maintain what we have as the highest priority. So we're going to seek funding to be able to continue existing services. And that entails not just capturing the available state and federal funding that's out there, but alternative funding sources. For example, the CCO is a potential funding source. Our second strategy is that as funding permits and as demands demonstrated, we'll improve services and expand them. And the advisory committee identified increased frequency of weekday service as the highest priority, a higher priority than weekend service. And it includes exploring options for expanding fixed route service to unserved areas, so perhaps the use of shuttles, volunteer drivers, etc. various actions there to improve the services, bus stops, shelters, etc. Our third strategy is how do we get the special needs populations to where they need to be? So there are a variety of actions there about expanding demand response services, leveraging the services at the state level. The Council of Government provides Rideline brokerage services for non-emergency medical transportation, and only 2% of the eligible county residents use that service. So we have some work to do to make sure they know about it. We have actions on continuing to improve service to veterans, involving the educational community, and so that we are matching transit services to college schedules, etc. Fourth strategy is support and increase the volunteer services we have out there. And this is primarily through a program of driver recruitment and training, and working with organizations such as Volunteer Caregivers. The fifth strategy is, again, a key component of the plan, coordinating with the human and health service sectors. And so that's really a number of actions talking about partnering. Our sixth strategy is regional collaboration with our partners in Bend County and Linn County and North Tillamook. And as been mentioned several times, we have the North by Northwest Connector Alliance, and the Coastal Valley Express is really a, you know, a model of that regional collaboration of getting folks from here into the valley where medical services are, Amtrak, et cetera. And then our second strategy is we need to continually inform the public about the services that are available out there, expand our efforts. And then lastly, mechanisms for routinely monitoring the plan and integrating with other planning processes. I intentionally ran through that very quickly. Happy to answer the questions.
Seems like a lot of common sense, but seems like a very good roadmap to get to the system we want. Cinda, would you want to weigh in? And then I don't know if anybody else. It seems heartening to me anyway with all the discussion of a transportation finance package in the legislature, that at least there's been a lot of acknowledgement of public demand for more transit services, and whether that hopefully maybe is a good sign for a long-term future of transit funding.
I'm hopeful.
Okay.
And in the efforts that ODOT did for outreach on the transportation package, transit was one of the top issues that people identified for additional funding.
It would be the legislature that did that.
Yeah.
But yes, we've had two different roadshows going on in the last couple of years. One was conducted by the governor's office and the legislative committees, and they identified public transit as very high need. The second one was SB 21, which was a bill from a couple of years ago that asked DHS to look at the cost of long-term care and how to bring that cost down. And you would not be surprised to know that transportation was in the top three. And so, and they did like 21 town halls with, you know, all over the state. So we are very comfortable with the idea that need is there. Now we just need to work on the funding part. And you know, Cinda does a great job working with the human service agencies here. I think they could step up a little more. And I don't know what that means exactly in this community, but I think she's making strides in that, and we appreciate all that. So thank you very much.
Thanks.
Thank you. I'm impressed you're making this progress. I've worked with several of you at different times in the past when I was a state representative. Still here. When we actually went to create the transportation system, we worked together.
Good to see you again.
Good to see you, and I'm remiss in sharing a joke with you. Do I dare?
Let me call the dog. Okay, go for it.
So I had a friend who was traveling in East Africa, and he came back with a story about these rural portions. He came across a witch doctor's hut, and there were a row of jars in front of it. And in one jar, there were grains of a NASA engineer, and there was a price tag of $500 an ounce for those brains. And next to it was a jar of a teacher's brain, and they were $200 an ounce. And next to that was a politician's brains.
Ooh.
And being careful here, and they were $2,000 an ounce. But next to that was a jar of consultant brains, and they were $10,000 an ounce. And my friend went up to the witch doctor and he says, you know, I understand the disparity in the cost among these three, but why are the consultant brains so expensive? And the witch doctor said, well, if you knew how many consultants I had to find to get an ounce of brains.
Very good.
Well, we used to work on marine reserves, and I don't know what the price is for fishermen's brains, but after that, there was getting to be a real shortage of that commodity, too. Well, good to see you again. Thank you very much for coming and telling us about this plan. Okay, we move down to, we've got nothing in the service district, so we have elected officials' reports. I don't see any elected officials here, so we move to commissioners' reports.
Okay, Mr. Chair, maybe one or two things I'd mention. Coming up next Monday, 10 o'clock, is going to be groundbreaking for expansion of our Newport Head Start facility. Funding has come through from the federal government for program and facility expansion. Some, and I'm sorry, I don't know, but not all of the slots in Head Start will be going from half-day slots to full-day slots in Newport, and that requires more classroom space, and a contractor has been selected, and they're ready to get to work on that. So
I'm not going to be able to make that one.
So I didn't think you were, and Commissioner Hunt is also going out of town next Monday, but I will be there to represent the board, because as board members of Community Services Consortium, we do have oversight of Head Start in Lincoln County, and I know it's a program all three of us have been strong believers in and advocates for, and this is a nice milestone to see happen.
Okay.
And I think I'll just leave it at that.
Well, I have a few things to talk about. First, we should mention, Bill, I haven't talked to you and Doug yet, but we had our meeting yesterday on solid waste. And Wayne, I'll let you talk a little bit about what's there, because I think it's a good thing we discuss in a public meeting, right?
Sure. Several of us were involved in code enforcement activities. Solid waste is just one of the elements that we look at, but it's code enforcement across all the various regulations we have and all the activities that we administer. We discussed ways that we could try and improve some of the activities we undertake. It's a difficult job for us in code enforcement, mainly because one of the key tools we would like to utilize is the courts, and the courts are very, very busy. And it's so it becomes somewhat difficult to move forward in certain areas on code enforcement actions because of the priorities that they have to do by law. And where other things then fall into place. So we discussed some alternatives for what we might do in the future, and I think we've come up with some recommendations we'll be making to you over the course of probably the next month or so to actually, we think, improve the process of doing code enforcement. And I will tell you this, it will involve the Lincoln County Sheriff's Office, folks from the Health and Human Services Department, our planning department. Those are kind of the key players in code enforcement activities, but we think that the end result will be a better system than we currently have in place.
Well, we are all trying to explain what you mean by code enforcement. It doesn't mean that much to the average person unless you explain what they're going to try to cover.
Sure. If somebody violates a provision of, let's say, the planning code, They do something that doesn't follow the code, have an illegal use as an example out there, don't get appropriate permits, whatever it might be in there. Follow-up that we do through our the system currently is we have employees who are charged with going out and trying to get compliance with the law, our local laws, which is the code, and work through a variety of mechanisms to try and get compliance. In the solid waste arena, I think the prevalent one we have is places that have unsanitary conditions. Or they may have, actually it's a combination, the unsanitary condition may be garbage that's piled up on a property. It may be a septic system that's failed and not working. So it creates health and safety issues. And these are the things that we get complaints about. We're a complaint-driven process right now, and we respond to those complaints and deal with it. I should add that Public Works also does that. I see Director Kenyon's also here. We occasionally have to deal with issues around roads and compliance with regulations around roads. So this is just the system in place to say, you know, how do we deal with complaints for compliance with the laws of the county?
Bill, I'm going to go a little bit farther.
Sure.
There's a possibility here that we'll create a new position, if everything would go right, possibly a related to VRDs. We already have a half-time position. We look at a possibility of actually making that into a full-time position and do code enforcement on these types of areas, like he's talking, and planning. And at this point, it's only a process. Now, I need another vote in order to go forward. And so you haven't heard anything about this issue. You knew that I started on a solid waste issue, but it's developed into a bigger program. So are you interested?
Oh, that's what I was going to say. Very interested, of course. You know, it's always, we have to review the details, the costs, etc. But conceptually, I'm very supportive of this. I know all three commissioners have dealt with these kind of complaints for years. And not only the health and safety type of issues that we've seen recently. There was one case last year up the abandoned property in North County, the property that was in foreclosure. What area was that, Mr. Belmont?
It was North County.
Yeah, north of Lincoln City.
Yes.
And this was a property that essentially, it was in foreclosure, the previous tenant was gone, but squatters were occupying it big time. And what really caused me to sit up and take notice was hearing that the sheriff's office over a period of several months had responded to, I believe, 13 calls at that property, resulting in 10 arrests. And that, you know, it sounds like, from what you've told me, that one of the outcomes of this will be better ongoing communication across all our departments about all of these properties. And I found that, for instance, legal counsel's office never had been made aware of this rash of arrests at that property. And then once the foreclosure was completed, I know then there was an owner of record once again, and we were able to move forward with enforcement on that. But yeah,
that's only one incident.
That's just one example. That's what I know. That's just one particular that I'd never really thought about, these properties becoming almost an attractive nuisance for people who want to cause trouble.
To me is one of those areas where we either step up and start turning around, because these types of things, they turn into health department issues. Solid waste, Amy does a great job, but she has cases where it worries me. She's out doing things that should be probably done by a law enforcement person just for her own safety. Planning department is frustrated.
Yep.
So this is an attempt to try to rectify some of this, to move forward, because when you have, and solid waste was the start of this, you get into so many other areas that it affects, that we have, I think that it's time we start to be more aggressive, because it grows. It's like a cancer. It grows. If you don't stop it at a certain point, it depreciates the property values of the people around them that are trying to take care of their property, and we lose money because of depreciated property value. If nothing else, if you want to talk just hard dollars, I think we can get back in the long term the money we spend by increased property values in the area, and then the consequences of it. It becomes a seed that develops into a cancer that I think we can, if nipped off quick enough and early enough, we can get better for the whole county.
So I'm with you.
With your direction, we'll come back to you with a package of recommendations. And again, I think the two key components here are, number one, we've never had a person dedicated to code enforcement. It's always been done by people who have many other responsibilities and duties. It's just part of their other duties as assigned. I usually look at it that they do. So we're talking about a dedicated a person or a portion of a person in code enforcement. And two, the coordination aspect. We can't underemphasize that, because that has been something that I think is extremely important. It seems like that when you have an issue in one area, it bleeds over in many other areas. It's not just a solid waste issue. It's usually a planning issue. There may be a criminal activity that's going on there too, many things. So we'll really work on that coordination and the approaches we take.
Well, good. Bill, one of the reasons, and I'm going to touch why this may happen, is this. The cities have gone to have code enforcement officers. I never thought about it. It was brought up in a meeting yesterday. They've increased their effort, and so some of this is moving into the county from the cities. And so
that would make sense.
I'd never thought about it before, but as they get more severe, these types of things move on. So we may be part of the reason we see the increase.
Well, you know, like when we were doing the vacation rental licensing, one of the people we heard testimony from was that somebody was buying a vacation rental in Glenedon Beach, said their realtor told them, you ought to buy outside of the city of Lincoln City, because the city regulates and licenses these and the county doesn't, but now we do.
Okay.
So that's a good example.
Yeah, that's exactly what we're running into. Same so now I want to talk about another issue. That's the initiative.
Okay.
And Wayne, will you tell us what we say, what we do at this point? Because up to now, we can't use any county resources and you can't make any comments. Tell us where we are now.
It's an interesting situation. I think in the 30 years I've been involved in doing things at the county, I've never seen something quite like this. And technically, where we're at right now is the election is not over. It will not be over until May 30th. Because there are outstanding ballots, and there's actually, as I understand now from the clerk talking to him today, they're from two sources. One is there was some 90 plus ballots that were not signed. They were they voted and turned in the envelope, but they did not sign their name to it, and they cannot count those ballots until a name is signed. So there's a process under state law for notifying those people and giving them, as I understand it, 14 days, which would be to May 30th, in which to come in and sign the envelope, and then those ballots can be counted. The current difference in votes between yeas and nays is 27. That also triggers, and at this point, if it stays at that margin, that triggers, as I understand it, an automatic recount, too. So we're in a situation now where actually for that particular measure at least, and potentially for others, the election is still ongoing, which means that I as a public employee can't talk in a way that would be perceived to be either supportive or in opposition to a ballot measurement. That's public employees can't do that. Commissioners can. You're elected officials. You can say what you want in regards to that. But I just want to know that I intend to talk to you at length about the measure once the decision is made, and frankly, we'll talk whether it passes or doesn't pass when the final votes are tallied.
And were you also going to mention ballots in other counties?
Yes, I'm sorry. The other thing is there are some ballots. You can turn in the ballot in another county. Historically, there's a few. The clerk did not have an estimate of what that is. I'm sure it's going to be not very many, but they do have to, they should get those hopefully by Friday if they return in another counties, is what it did indicate. So it's very interesting that the outcome is not yet fully determined, and that it does potentially trigger an automatic recount. So we'll have more to say when the final results are known.
So at this point, we can respond.
Mm-hmm. Staff can.
And we'll wait, I think. Public talk about this from Doug's here and all of us, because this could have pretty major consequences to the county and the state too. It's bigger than just us. So, had that. Then the third issue I want to talk about is I won't be here next week. It seemed like every meeting for a long time, but I was invited to the Google campus in San Francisco for a meeting on undersea cables. I work on with undersea cables. We installed a cable not too long ago with Google, and they wanted to meet with the Oregon Fishermen's Cable Committee, so I'll be down there next Wednesday. I'll actually be down there for 3 days working on it. We have great relationships now with Google and Microsoft and different cable companies that I never thought I'd be working with, especially sitting down having meetings and invited to go to their campus and see what the modern technology is. So that's kind of exciting for me.
Oh, maybe I should mention that I will be joining the meeting next week by telephone, so Commissioner Hunt will be the only one in the room, but I'll be at a conference in Sun River, National Association of Counties, their Western Interstate region, which includes the 15 westernmost counties in the United States.
So, with that, is there any constituent input? Seeing none, then we're adjourned the meeting, but I'll tell you first that our next meeting is Mason. We have May 17th Budget Committee meeting.
Tonight?
Here in the courtroom, so tonight we'll have a meeting here, and the next scheduled meeting is next Wednesday, and that's also scheduled for here next Wednesday at 9:30 a.m.
Okay.
Meeting.